welcome to This Week in History Class. I'm your host, John Larson. This week on the podcast, we have a number of things going on, looking mostly at the 1960s. And we've got a number of things from culture to things that are going around in the world to movie reviews. And we have, for the first time on the podcast, interviews, personal interviews done by our students with people they knew. So looking forward to that. Looking forward to hearing what they've got to say. All right, we're going to get started right away here. First on the podcast, we're going to look at a couple of different things from the world of machinery and agriculture. First off, we've got Jaden talking to us about the history of John Deere tractors, and then we've got Will telling us a little bit about the first snowmobile.
I'm going to talk about John Deere tractors in the 1960s. But before that, before the 1960s, they had tractors that only had about anywhere from 23 to 70 horsepower. But then in the 1960s, they introduced with the 2010 all the way up to the 4010, which had anywhere from about 39 horsepower to about 72 horsepower. And then by the mid of the 60s, they had the series of the 020s, which entered the 1020 with about 32 horsepower, the 2020 with about 44 horsepower, 3020 had about 55 horsepower, and the 4020 had about 75 to 83 horsepower, depending upon the model, but that's probably the best tractor ever made. And then you got the biggest one that they have, which was the 5020, which had about 114 to 122 horsepower. And you could get these in either diesel, gas, kerosene, LP gas, or distill. And Deere Company operates worldwide.
I will be talking about when the first snowmobile was made. Carl Ellingson of Saner, Wisconsin, was a man who spent 31 years inventing and perfecting the motor toboggan. He was a man that loved the outdoors, hunting, fishing, and trapping. Carl found it difficult to keep up with his pals because he had a bad foot. So he began his journey to create the first snowmobile. He was a blacksmith and a dealer of a modern outboard motors, modified a 2.5 horsepower outboard for his power plant and fashioned the frame to a metal headed over a coal stove. Steam for water boiling in the family wash tub formed the wooden skis. He averaged 8 machines in the winter and still found time to experiment with projected environments. In 1932, he introduced a better model that was powered by a converted motorcycle engine. It could go over 40 miles per hour. They were found extremely useful in the northern areas for hunting, trapping, and other winter sports and work. He paved the way for the other manufacturers.
Thanks, guys. Now we're going to look at what's going on in the United States culturally in the 1960s. We're going to look at a couple of things with in politics, the Black Panthers and the space race, for instance. Then we're going to look at a couple other things that are going on, including Jimi Hendrix, a little bit of music with Jimi Hendrix. Then we're going to look at the escape from Alcatraz, the famous escape. Peyton will be giving us that. And then we're going to look at sports in the 1960s, golf and swimming to be exact. Brandon's going to take the golf and Isaac is going to take the swimming. Following that, we've got three movie reviews of two different movies. The first two movie reviews will be To Kill a Mockingbird, the first by Megan and then Morgan and Morgan. And the second is by Courtney. And they're, again, both of those are going to be To Kill a Mockingbird. And then Noah's going to tell us a little bit about Spartacus.
All right, so we're doing the Black Panthers. In October of 1966 in Oakland, California, Huey Newton and Bob Seale founded the Black Panther Party for self-defense. The Panthers practiced militant self-defense of minority communities against the United States government and fought to establish revolutionary socialism through mass organization based on community programs. One of the main languages of the Black Panthers was violence, as they were in public places. The two founders were Huey Percy Newton and Bobby Seale. They wanted revolution. They wanted a revolutionary war, but though they considered themselves African American Party, they were willing to speak out for all those who opposed whatever minority group that they were for. They were willing to use violence to get whatever they wanted and whenever they needed it. The Black Panther Party had four desires, and they had a 10-point plan to get them.
The Black Panther Party was a progressive political organization that stood in the vanguard of the most powerful movement for social change in America since the Revolution of 1776 and the Civil War. That dynamic episode, generally referred to as the 60s, it is the sole black organization in the entire history of black struggle against slavery and oppression in the United States that was armed and promoted a revolutionary agenda, and it represents the last great thrust by the masses of black people for equality and justice and freedom. The party's ideals and activities were so radical that it was at one time labeled by FBI Chief J. Edgar Hoover as the greatest threat to international security of the United States. And despite the demise of the party, its history and lessons remain so challenging and controversial that established texts and media erase all reference to the party from their portrayals of American history.
During the late 1960s, there was a push to try to get to the moon. The race was between the Soviet Union and the United States. The race started in the year 1955. The Soviets were the first in space with the Sputnik 1, which was a small satellite that broadcasted radio pulses. Then, on July 20, 1969, Neil Armstrong set the first foot on the moon. When he set out on the moon, he said his famous quote, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." There's a lot of controversy surrounding the moon landing. Many people think that the U.S. actually filmed the moon landing in a studio just so we could say that we were the first people to land on the moon. There are a couple of different things that conspiracy theorists agree on. One, when the flag is planted, the original footage shows that the flag is waving. How does a flag wave when there is no wind or air in space? Two, in one of the pictures, there are a group of rocks, and in the background, you see a landing module. The shadows of the rocks point in a completely different direction than the module. That means there must have been two different light sources, right? Three, in the pictures that you see of the Earth that are taken from the moon, they have no stars in them. People suggest that this is because NASA could not map out the exact location of the stars and therefore left them out of the picture. Four, and finally, many people have noticed that some of the pictures that are taken have the exact same backdrop in them, but different things in the foreground of the picture. Does this mean that NASA used a backdrop and props? There are a lot of controversies surrounding the moon landing, but NASA and even the Mythbusters have proven that there is a logical explanation for each of these conundrums.
Hi, my name is Dean, and I will be talking to you about Jimi Hendrix today. James Marshall, or Jimi Hendrix, his real name when he was born was Johnny Alex Hendrix, was born on November 27th, 1942, and died on September 18th, 1970. He was an American guitarist, singer, and songwriter. Although his mainstream career spanned only 4 years, he is widely regarded as one of the most influential electric guitarists in the history of popular music, and one of the most celebrated musicians of the 20th century. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame describes him as arguably the greatest instrumentalist in the history of rock music. Born in Seattle, Washington, Hendrix began playing guitar at the age of 15. In 1961, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. He was granted an honorable discharge the following year. Soon afterward, he moved to Clarksville, Tennessee, and began playing gigs on the Chitlin Circuit, earning a place in the Isley Brothers backing band and later with Little Richard, with whom he continued to work through mid-1965. He then played with Curtis Knight and the Squires before moving to England in late 1966 after being discovered by Linda Keith, who in turn interested bassist Chas Chandler and the Animals in becoming his first manager. Within months, Hendrix had earned 3 UK top 10 hits with the Jimi Hendrix Experience, Hey Joe, Purple Haze, and The Wind Cries Mary. He achieved fame in the U.S. after his performance at the Monterey Pop Festival in 1967, and in 1968, his third and final studio album, Electric Ladyland, reached number 1 in the U.S. The double LP was Hendrix's most commercially successful release and his first and only number 1 album. The world's highest paid performer, he headlined the Woodstock Festival in 1969 and the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970 before his accidental death from drug-related use on September 18th, 1970, at the age of 27.
I'm assuming all of you have heard of Alcatraz and the Great Escape. Today I'm going to tell you about it. It's the night of June 11th, 1962. Frank Morris, Alan West, and the Anglin brothers, Clarence and John, have been digging holes in their cell walls with all the acquired tools and spoons for about a year. They'd also made dummy heads of soap, toilet paper, and real hair to give the illusion they were in bed. They went out through the holes they had made into a service vent, which they had shimmied through onto the roof. All but one, West had some technical issues and could not make it, which is odd because he claims to be the mastermind of the plan in later interviews. After they had made it out, they had created a raft out of over 50 cotton raincoats and blew it up on the shore. Guards are said to have heard a noise at some point that night, but disregarded it as nothing. From there, they went into the water. They are never heard from again, at least to the public. Their bodies were never found, and since then it has been proven they could have actually made it back even through the tides of San Francisco Bay. If they had made it, it would be the only successful escape from Alcatraz in 29 years of it being open. There had been 14 separate tries and 36 inmates who attempted it. They were all caught or shot by a guard, all except John Paul Scott in 1962. He made it out, but was caught very quickly at Fort Point. So the mystery of the Great Escape still stands and may never be solved. That's all I have for you. Thanks for listening.
Golf in the 1960s. In the 1960s, there were 3 really dominant players. One was Gary Player, who won 63 tournaments in the decade. Another player was Jack Nicklaus, who won 11 tournaments, of which 7 were majors. The last player is Arnold Palmer. Arnold Palmer won, in the 1960s, 8 major tournaments and got Player of the Year twice, once of which was in 1960 and one in 1962, which he got Player of the Year. All these guys made the game of what it is today, which is very competitive.
Hello, I'm Isaac Atkinson, and I'm going to be talking to you about swimming in the 1960s. There were Summer Olympics in the 1960, 1964, and 1968. The 1960 Olympics were held in Rome, Italy, and that was the first time the 4x100 medley relay was introduced into the Olympics. There were 2 main powerhouses in the 60s, and they were Australia and the United States. The 1964 Olympics were held in Tokyo, Japan, where the U.S. dominated the swimming portion, scoring 29 total medals. The 1968 Olympics were held in Mexico City, Mexico, and this was one of the best years the United States ever had as a swimming program, where they scored 52 out of the 87 total medals.
For this week in history class, we will be doing a movie review on the movie To Kill a Mockingbird. This movie came out in 1962, based on the 1960 book To Kill a Mockingbird, written by Harper Lee. The movie is set in Macomb, Alabama, during the 1930s, and is following the Finch family.
The narrator's 6-year-old girl, named Scout, shows us her life and how she sees what's going on in the 1930s. She has tons of adventures with her brother, Jim, and her newfound friend, who moves to town, Dill. So the things that were going on that Jim, Dill, and Scout had to figure out was where the mysterious treasures were coming from and what it was like to walk in someone else's skin, like their scary neighbor, Boo Radley.
The town gets all stirred up when an African-American man is accused of raping a young woman. Miss Maddie's house starts on fire in the middle of the night. There was also a small problem with a mad dog that wandered into town. His name was Tom Johnson. Scout's dad, Atticus, had to go out in the middle of the street and shoot it.
Overall, the book is a book of great insight. It shows you what's going on in the 1930s and how people would try to get away with things because of the color discrimination that was going on. One of the big themes in the book was, you will never really understand a person till you consider things from his point of view, until you climb inside his skin and walk around in it. This plays a big part in the book to help show that we are all equal. Atticus, Scout's dad, tries to teach Jem and her this lesson the whole book and show that everyone's equal. He does this by being an attorney for an African-American who is on trial in a time period when whites do not represent blacks.
Hey guys, today I will be talking to you about one of the most popular movies in the 1960s, To Kill a Mockingbird. The book To Kill a Mockingbird was published in 1960, and only 2 years later, in 1962, it was made into a film. The author Harper Lee wrote the story based off events that happened near her hometown. The film was directed by Robert McGilligan, and it won 3 Academy Awards. The film To Kill a Mockingbird stars Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch, Mary Badham as Scout, and Brock Peters as Tom Robertson. The plot of the film deals with the civil rights and how a black man was accused of assaulting a white girl rather than who actually assaulted her. When Atticus was appointed to defend Tom Robertson, his family was viewed as a town outcast because he was defending a black man. Tom made the mistake by making the statement, "I felt sorry for her," and in a town where whites were viewed superior to blacks, his sympathy towards her doomed his case, and he was found guilty. Thanks for listening to my podcast.
I'm doing a movie review on the movie Spartacus from 1960. It is about a slave that leads a revolt at a gladiator school run by a brute. The uprising soon spreads across the Italian peninsula involving thousands of slaves. The plan is to acquire sufficient funds to acquire ships from pirates who could then transport them to other lands. The Roman senator schemes to have the commander lead an army against the slaves, but he is defeated by the slaves. So the slaves are led by Spartacus, and he is played in the movie by Kirk Douglas. Some other stars in the movie are Crassus. He is played by Lawrence Olivier. Julius Caesar is played by John Gavin. Marcellus is played by Charles McCraw. This movie was a multi-million dollar production and is one of the most famous movies known to the 1960s.
All right, now we're going to look outside the country. We're going to look at a couple different places. First, Aaron is going to tell us about the Berlin Wall that went up in the 1960s. And Anno is going to tell us about Japan in the 1960s and what's going on over there.
Welcome to This Week in History class. Today I'm going to be talking about the rise and fall of the Berlin Wall. On August 13, 1961, the government of the German Democratic Government began to build the wall between East and West Berlin. The Berlin Wall was 12 feet tall and 4 feet wide with concrete and barbed wire, which made it nearly impossible to cross. The purpose of building the wall was to keep the Western fascists from entering East Germany. Before the wall was built, people could cross the East-West border to shop, work, and go to the movies. Trains and subway lines also carried passengers back and forth. After the wall was built, it became nearly impossible to get from the east to west side. The only way you could cross was going through one of the 3 checkpoints. Eventually, there became 12 checkpoints along the wall. The checkpoints were mostly used for officials because travelers could not cross. Behind the East German Wall, it was called the Death Strip. It was called this because there were vicious dogs, tripwire machine guns, and patrolling soldiers with orders to shoot the people that tried crossing. There were at least 171 people that were killed trying to get over, under, or around the Berlin Wall. One of the first people to get killed trying to cross the wall was Peter Fetcher. He was 18 years old and a bricklayer. Him and his friend Helmut were trying to cross and climb the wall. He was shot by the East Germans on August 17, 1962. The East German border guards let him bleed to death. The fall of the wall happened on November 9, 1989. The East Communist Party announced a change in the city's relationship with the West. Starting at midnight that day, people were allowed to cross the wall freely. People flocked to the wall with hammers and picks to knock away. Soon after, the wall was knocked down by the East, and West Berlin were united for the first time since 1945. The Berlin Wall Memorial is located in the middle of the capital. The memorial contains the last piece of the wall. To this day, the Berlin Wall has remained one of the most powerful symbols of the Cold War.
Hi, I'm Anno. I'm gonna talk about Japanese films in the 1960s. It was in June of 1966 that the Beatles, one of the most popular bands in the world, arrived in Japan. They caused as much pandemonium when they triggered Beatlemania in the United States in 1964. A total of 8,400 policemen were mobilized for security at a cost of $4 million, and more than 6,500 Japanese teenagers were taken into custody. They had been in Japan for 102 hours and were paid $2.8 million. The teens who listen to rock and roll and rockabilly are called rockers. They adore the US, ride motorcycles made in the UK. They wear leather jackets and jeans, and their popular hairstyle was regent. They love to ride their motorcycles so much. They race and drive almost 100 miles per hour, so it became a social problem. There were also the teens called mods. They listen to rhythm and blues, jazz, and soul music. They ride motor scooters rather than motorcycles to keep their clothes from getting dirty with the oil. They prefer Italian motor scooters. They love Italian fashion, and they wear short jackets, which have two or three buttons. The girls were obsessed with miniskirts. Courage, a French fashion brand, displayed miniskirts at Haute Couture Collection in 1965. Until then, people thought knees were the ugliest skirts. The skirts were just like short enough to be able to see your knees. They sold them in Japan in 1965 for the first time, but it was Twiggy, an English model, who triggered the pandemic of miniskirts in Japan. She arrived in Japan in 1967. After that event, almost all the girls started to wear miniskirts. Thank you for listening to my podcast.
Finally this week, we're going to get three interviews from three of our students. First, AJ is going to interview his dad, who, as he puts it, was around in the 1960s. Then Luke is going to tell us a little bit about a conversation he had with his grandma about her remembering of the 1960s. And then finally, Andrew is going to tell us about what his grandma remembers about the 1960s.
All right, Dad, why don't you tell us a little bit about the 60s since you were there?
Okay, I'm going to start at the last part of it where civil rights they had some riots in places like Detroit and East L.A. A lot of those things that happened with Martin Luther King and that sort of thing, where I was at in North Dakota, we heard about it, but we didn't actually see very much of it. Because we didn't have any black population. I had three of my high school buddies who went into the Army and went over to Vietnam. I didn't. They all came back. It was pretty bad over there, I guess. And some of the guys that graduated before me went over and they experienced the Tet Offensive and that sort of thing. The moon landing, I remember watching that on television, and I thought it was pretty awe-inspiring for America to be able to do something like that. I remember when Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were shot. I remember when people talking about that. And what else was there that went on in the late 60s?
Kennedy when the other guy shot.
Oh, President Kennedy. I remember when he was killed.
Yeah.
November 22nd, 1963, in live. And then Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald live on television. My dad and I looked at that on Sunday morning, watching him being gunned down in the underground parking lot there. Anything else?
I think that's good.
Okay.
Thank you.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was my father talking about the 60s which he lived through as a teen.
Hi, welcome to This Week in History podcast with Luke Schultz. I will be talking about the life in the 1960s from my grandma's interview. One of the first questions I asked her went along with our unit with JFK. I asked her what was everything like when JFK was assassinated. She said she found out from her husband almost instantly about JFK's assassination, and the news just blew up and everyone was talking about it. Kennedy was a very well-liked president, she said, and the mood everywhere was very sad and gloomy. She also compares it to like the day of 9/11, when the tragedy happened. After talking about that, asked her what kinds of music was popular and that she listened to in the 60s. She said it was very hard to remember, but she would mainly like to listen to the Supremes, which was a girl group, and also the Beatles, which mainly everyone had heard of that name before. Other popular groups were the Rolling Stones, but she wasn't really interested in them very much. The last question I asked her was, what kind of entertainment were you involved in the 1960s? She stated that going to friends' houses and just playing cards was what they would do quite a bit. Also, dances and drive-in movies were popular, but she was in Grove City, so there wasn't many things going on.
Hello, I'm Andrew Kulzer, bringing you an interview for my History Extra. Today with me, I have my grandma here to talk to you about life in the 60s. So, grandma, could you introduce yourself and tell us about some things that are different than nowadays?
Sure. My name is Mary Kulzer. Life in the 60s, it was a little different. Women weren't in the workforce as heavy as they are now. They were just starting to be out in the workforce. Most families had one car. The Vietnam War was going on. A lot of the boys joined the National Guards because they didn't want to be drafted and end up going to Vietnam. School was pretty much 57 minutes for each class, and we had a lot of typing, shorthand, bookkeeping, FFA, shop classes, home ec, phi ed. The boys didn't take home ec, and the girls didn't take shop.
And before the interview, my grandma showed me some of the shorthand. She showed me how she would write, "Life is different." It's ridiculous. They have life as something that looks like a Q mixed with a J. Was looks like a U, and different is just a slash. Kind of looks silly. Anyway, can you tell us about rock music and stuff we learned in history class that was kind of taboo or by your parents.
Yeah, Elvis was really hot. Elvis Presley. He had the greatest voice and he was new. Everybody liked him. All the girls were just wow when he came on. And the Beatles were very big. And so we teenagers would be dancing. But in those days, the dancing was not holding onto each other like way back when our parents grew up. So our parents thought our dancing was kind of weird. But we had a lot of fun.
Did your parents find it, how should I say, appropriate? Or?
Well, not really. They thought we were just jumping around. And they didn't really care for Elvis or any of those Beatles and that type of thing.
Huh. Well, thank you, Grandma.
You're welcome.
This concludes my part of the history extra. Hope you guys liked it and didn't fall asleep during that. Bye for now.
Thanks to everyone who participated in that. I thought it was a great job this week. Really appreciated it. And it was really fun to hear the interviews that were done this week. I hope we get some more of those as we go along. I know as we get going here later and later in the period that we're talking about in the 20th and then early 21st century, obviously we'll have a few more people that were around during that point. So hopefully we can get some more interviews. I want to thank everyone again for doing their part this week. Looking forward to getting fourth quarter going here and talking about kind of the later 60s period, but also Vietnam coming up and the 70s and then obviously closer to what we are, close to the present. Again, I want to thank, special thanks to Ethan Frazier for our theme music. If you would like to message us, you can tweet at us. We are at TWIHC at TWIC on Twitter. Or if you want to message me or tweet at me, or, you know, hopefully not be too mean, but I'm at Teacher J Lars on Twitter. I'm also at Teacher J Lars on Instagram. Again, thank you so much for listening. Looking forward to hearing from you and hope you enjoyed the show. Again, this has been This Week in History Class.